May it please the Court, Tim McCaffrey on behalf of Appellant Juan Perez. May I reserve 2 or 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honors?
Sure.
Thank you. I think this case represents a unique opportunity for the Court to use this procedural history to create a few good rules for us who litigate below on when it's right to remove a case and how you should do it. In this particular situation, we have a complaint that plainly alleges the same causes of action. It gets removed. The defendant makes certain arguments. Those arguments are rejected. In between, we filed the First Amendment complaint that has the same exact causes of action.
You expanded the scope of the lawsuit.
By 2 years. But the same arguments...
That was a pretty significant change, right?
I don't agree that it was significant enough to meet the mountain controversy.
You changed the scope, though. More was at stake.
Of course, more is at stake by virtue of the fact that 2 years are added. But at the same time, the same argument is there about this 100% violation because of the route restriction that was pled in the original complaint. It was also pled in the First Amendment complaint. So why should the defendant have another bite at that apple and make an argument that they didn't make the first time,
well,
the second time?
Because you amended the complaint.
Yeah, it's not quite correct.
Well, okay. I mean, our view is that, that they, if they have a chance to do it, they should do it right the first time. I think that's what Seidman says. I think, you can't just keep hijacking a case because you want to try again with a different removal or a different argument to support removal.
Well, they couldn't. You argued to the district court that they couldn't rely on the amended complaint in district court.
Well, that's not exactly true because in our reply, we opened up by saying that neither the original complaint nor the First Amendment complaint supports allows the amount in controversy requirement to be met. We did challenge the defendant's, attempt to use the First Amendment complaint and chided them for not citing authority for the proposition that they could use it. But we went on to analyze the fact that the First Amendment complaint did not allow for them to...
the basic rule on removal, at least as I recall from my days in the district court, was that you look at the jurisdictional issues at the time the complaint is removed, and so you're looking at the first complaint that was removed.
That's right, and certainly if a plaintiff was to make adjustments or try to avoid jurisdiction, those amendments should not be considered. But there are cases that just the opposite. If it's going to invest the court with jurisdiction, they ought to be considered, because the whole point of a removal is to get it up. If it's in federal court, then it should be there, and it should be there properly. Why wouldn't you consider the
allegations? Right, but can you have it both ways? You were before the district court on the original complaint. You took the position that the court should not look at the allegations in the First Amendment complaint because you're saying that, look, the amount in controversy following removal is irrelevant, but yet there's a First Amendment complaint filed there. So district court accepted your argument. It went back. So if we accept that the First Amendment complaint has new allegations that would increase the amount in controversy, why shouldn't the defendant get to come back again on the First Amendment complaint? Because they didn't get a chance the first time around. You won on that argument.
I just respectfully disagree that we won that argument. I think the court did say that in its order, but if you look at our reply brief at ER Volume 4, 474, 475, 476, we addressed the First Amendment complaint. We recognize that it's there in its full glory, and they're arguing that the same issues are presented by it, and, the court had its chance to do it. I firmly believe that the idea that, we're going to send the litigants back to state court, and then we're going to come back again months later, it's just delaying, the prosecution of the case. It's delaying
the
litigation.
It might be more efficient to do it the way you suggest, but the way our case law has evolved, it's, as long as there was a significant change,
that's what I'm advocating.
It looks like the removal here, the second removal, was not a successive, repetitive kind of thing. It was a proper removal.
I submit to the court to consider whether the case law truly addresses this particular procedural fact pattern. I think it's a unique situation because it is more efficient to do what I'm advocating now. I firmly believe that. I think we all would agree with that. Why should we go back to state court only to come back again and fight about the same things? It's sitting right there.
Well, would it be different if you hadn't filed the First Amendment complaint in federal court? Let's say you have the original complaint, you prevail, it got remanded, and then you file the First Amendment complaint. You're saying even under that circumstance, defendants shouldn't get to try for a second time to remove to federal court?
No, I think they can in that circumstance try to remove again because now I've filed in state court. But all I would say in response to defendant's second removal in that situation is you're stuck with the arguments you made the first time. So if you're not going to claim 100% violation to get to your mountain controversy the first time around, which we pled, you don't get to do it the second time. Why do you get to keep making different arguments just because the math the first time around didn't work out for you? They have a responsibility to do it properly the first time they do it. That's what Seidman says. So if they wanted to argue 100% violation, they should have done it the first time. They didn't. So they shouldn't be allowed to do it the second time. Okay? I just think that makes sense, too, from an efficiency standpoint, because you're just allowing them to do it again and again and again.
So let's assume they're now in federal court. Let's just assume for a moment, continuing on with the argument, that the removal, second removal was okay, but was not an impermissible successive. Why don't they meet the... What are we talking about? $75,000 jurisdictional limit? Because we're dealing with
a single plaintiff.
With diversity.
Single plaintiff wage and hour case. I have no idea what the exact number is, but the amount of single plaintiff wage and hour cases filed in Los Angeles County Superior Court has to be astronomically high, in the thousands. If we're going to say that this single plaintiff wage and hour case meets the $75,000 jurisdictional amount, we're going to have a flood of cases coming through the federal court. But based on diversity, I can't imagine. I mean, we went through the math.
What's your route restriction theory?
The route restriction theory applies to meals, and because that's what the route restriction policy said. It applies to meal breaks. They can't leave the truck, and they can't leave the route within a 1 mile radius. So the route restriction theory is that they're on duty during that meal period. This is therefore
and rest breaks too, right? So meal and rest breaks.
See, that's
So you gotta stay by the truck.
It's a sloppily pled First Amendment complaint. If you read paragraph 16 of the First Amendment complaint, the route restriction theory in the underline says it's all about meal, all about meal, all about meal for the first four sentences, and the very last sentence concludes, therefore or accordingly, plaintiff pleads that they were not, he did not get his meal and or rest breaks. It's just a poorly drafted complaint because the route restriction was always about the meals. It's about the meals in the original. It's about the meals in the First Amendment. It's always about the meals. So you shouldn't count our point on the mountain controversy is the rest period should not count. 100% violation does not hold true with the route restriction. That's only for the meal periods. And we've said it in the briefs, and we try to explain it. But I agree that the complaint, paragraph 16, I guess it is
what it is.
It is what it is. But, I mean, I think the court is allowed to interpret it and say, yeah, I can see what they're really talking about here, and it's not rest periods. It's meal periods. So the extent that, the plaintiff put in and/or and stuck rest, and does that really support 100%
violation?
Well,
but why doesn't that theory also extend to rest breaks when drivers have to basically remain on their routes at all times? They're not allowed to leave.
Well, point one, the policy itself is just for the meals. Point two, so it's not about rest breaks. Point two is that rest breaks, unlike meal breaks, you're allowed to keep the employee on property. So to the extent you're saying, you have to stay with your truck, that's your moving property, that's not going to be a rest break violation per se. So that's the response. We cited the regs for that. But, to us, the idea that, you would do 100% violation on that doesn't make sense. And I think it also gets to this, the point of what level of proof does the defendant really have to have when it makes its removal. I mean, they have access to records that could show when and if Mr. Perez didn't get his rest break, based on his time records and based on they have a whole GPS system in his truck. If they wanted to sit down and figure out how many rest breaks he might not have gotten under our theory, they certainly could do it. It wouldn't be 100%. So our other point is the idea that, hey, on removal, you should have summary judgment type evidence to support your position. And if you don't, and instead you have, conflicting inferences.
Well, you don't dispute this is their policy.
Well, no, the policy is
our
case.
Right?
Our policy, though, is about meals, not about rest breaks. So that's why I'm urging the court to look through my poorly drafted First Amendment complaint, the one sentence that says meal under arrest, and say this is really a meal break issue, the 100% violation. Again, that gets back to why do they get to argue it a different way the second time around when the same allegations were in the original complaint? Why should all of a sudden it go from assuming 3 breaks to 10? I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's right. I don't think they should get that second bite at the apple. They have access to the information. They have the allegations in front of them. They should do it right the first time. They shouldn't hijack the case. So we went through the math. We think we get to 52,878.98. One of the issues that's come up in certainly on the reply papers is the how far back can they go, and this gets to something that's always completely baffled me in this case. There was a case that was filed before Perez, Mr. De La Cueva, our client, filed the same class action. It got rejected because he had an individual wrongful term case, and the court deemed him to be an unfit rep or not an adequate class rep because of his interest in his wrongful term case. While that case was pending, the Sakita case was already out there. Altadena took the position through its counsel that they were not related. They had nothing to do with one another. The Akita case was the Swiss carryover case, and they submitted court documents saying they're not related. Perez comes along, which is basically Miguel De La Cueva too, filed the exact same idea, same causes of action, same theories, but no wrongful term case. So now we address the adequacy of the class rep. And now they say it's related to Akita, and Judge Real snaps it up, even though before he had rejected De La Cueva. And now they're arguing, even though they had said it's not related, that we get to go back and count the 2006. If anyone should be judicially stopped from making such an argument, it should be Altadena, because that is how can De La Cueva not be related but Perez be related to Akita? It just doesn't make sense. So that cuts off 2 years also of their calculation. And I think not to beat a dead horse, the 203 penalty was in the original complaint. It's in the First Amendment complaint. Why should they get to ignore the 203 penalty for the first time they removed the case, but now argue for it in the First Amendment complaint? I just don't see why you get to keep trying until you get it right. I don't think that's consistent with the policy behind removal. The other big ticket items, two more, the 226.3 penalty is a civil penalty that's predicated on a citation. They take the maximum on that. There's no allegation of a citation being issued. It shouldn't count at all. It's really, I don't know of any case that's awarded a 226.3 civil penalty to a plaintiff in California or in this circuit. And the last is the attorney's fees. They want to take 25% of the common fund as if it were a class action, but it's not, because at this point they're removing it as if it were an individual case. So it's the lodestar method, and if you do the lodestar method, the authorities are that you should, I think, prorate it based on the number of representatives. So it's $400 at the time of removal. So otherwise attorney's fees would hijack every single case into federal court, because we all know these individual cases that come with attorney's fees. If I have a $10,000 overtime case, at the end of my trial my attorney's fees could be 12 times that, 10 times, and certainly get me over the jurisdictional minimum. So that this case presents an opportunity for the court to define, these different issues so we know how to act below.
Okay.
Thank you.
Did you want to say the motion to dismiss? After Judge Real determined your proper removal and met the $75,000, he then turned to the motion to dismiss under 12b-6, and even though it was only a partial attack, part of the allegations in the complaint.
And then he got their case.
Kicked everything, and as I understand it, the other side recognizes that they were only dealing with a part of the claim.
I believe that's right. I mean, I read their papers again, thoroughly. I think we all agree that the point of their motion to dismiss was to argue CBA preemption, and that only applied as of January 1, 2011. So that you can't dismiss the entire cause of action because there's in remedies that exist prior to the CBA preemption or exception.
Right.
And then in addition, you know, it also only deals, the CBA preemption only deals with meals, and it only deals with overtime. And there's allegations within the first and second causes of actions regarding rest and also just straight time wages. So the CBA preemption couldn't address that. Finally, there was a case that came out after Judge Reel's order, the Perry case, and the district court case, that you know challenges whether or not the CBA preemption really can be you know adjudicated on a motion to dismiss. I mean, without the benefit of any discovery, without the benefit of getting into whether or not the CBA actually meets the statutory requirements of the California Labor Code, I think it's premature to on a motion to dismiss just to you know accept that at face value. There were a lot of moving parts here, so we did argue also that, that you know in its entirety the motion to dismiss should be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from the other side.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Stephen Sklaver of Sussman Godfrey for the defendant, Altadena Certified Dairy. I do want to start, even though the issue has not been raised, Altadena is the cross-appellant, and both parties do concede on the issue, which for which there is a circuit split, that Judge Reel ultimately sua sponte remanded our case was error. I do want to start with it only because parties can't stipulate to jurisdiction, and so we have raised the issue in our brief that the court made a fundamental error by conflating mandatory original diversity jurisdiction with discretionary supplemental jurisdiction. And here, as the case laws we cite, including St. Paul and Geographic Expeditions, show that that was error. And if the amount of controversy is satisfied and there's no clear error in that regard, regardless of what happens on the motion to dismiss, that the case should stay in federal
right.
court. On the issue of the motion to dismiss addressed at the end, I do want to confirm, as stated in our briefs, we do agree that the motion should not have been granted to the extent it was. We only sought it for meal breaks and overtime, not rest breaks and straight time. And we also agree that it shouldn't be granted for the time period that precedes the enactment of the CBA statute. And in fact, we go even further. The CBA's that we submitted in evidence through judicial notice that was undisputed in the case helped establish that they weren't enacted even until June 2011. So there wouldn't be a dismissal until June 1, 2011. That's all provided
If we
for.
Agree with you on the jurisdictional issue, how should we handle that?
The appeal, it is an interlocutory appeal that's appropriate. It's a collateral order to the failure to exercise discretion to the supplemental jurisdiction point. So what would happen is the court would partial affirmance and partial reversal on that motion to dismiss. So we would affirm the dismissal of the meal break and overtime claims after the CBAs are effective June 1st, 2011, and then reverse as to the time that precedes that time frame as well as the rest break and straight time claims. It would be a partial affirmance and partial reversal in that
okay.
regard.
So getting to the jurisdictional.
So getting to the jurisdiction
the
point.
Removal.
A big issue of dispute here is whether or not the court should start digging into the merits of the case or not. And it is bedrock law that for purposes of jurisdiction, you don't determine the merits because the issue is not whether the defendant will or will not prevail at the end of the case. The issue is what's at controversy according to the four corners of the complaint or any evidence.
Well, what's different in the First Amendment complaint that shifted the assumption from 3 missed breaks per week to 100% violation?
It's the route restriction theory. If you look at the
That wasn't in the original complaint?
Not of the details that was provided for in the First Amendment complaint. In fact, if you look in the record, there's a red line of the First Amendment complaint. And if you look at paragraph 16 of that red line, it's in the record at page 111. In fact, just to put this back in context before I get there, the complaint was pending and Altadena filed a motion to dismiss. The grounds for our motion to dismiss was that the original complaint was too vague about the frequency of the meal breaks. Then the plaintiff amended the complaint, as is their right under the federal rules, and mooted our motion to dismiss, and has an extensive red line that the court will see, starting on paragraph 16, that goes all the way through paragraph 26. So it's pages 111 through 115, where the plaintiff now goes in painstaking detail about why the route restriction theory renders every break on duty, both meal and rest break. It starts in paragraph 16 with the concluding sentence that now the plaintiff wants adjudicated on the merits as being sloppily written, which is not a defense to removal. There is number 17 that talks about the meal and break policies at issues there. And how there's a failure to adjust routes and delivery schedules, and it goes on. So that's the new paragraphs 16 through 26. In addition, there is a footnote to paragraph 26. It's footnote 3. You'll also see that in the red line and in the complaint. And that talks about Zeta Records, X-A-T-A. Zeta is the onboard truck computer that the plaintiff alleged he used to swipe in and out for breaks. In this new allegation, the plaintiff states that a review of the Zeta records, quote, easily demonstrates, end quote, all the meal and rest break violations at issue in the case. And so on removal, we submitted the Zeta records in electronic format for this particular plaintiff and looked at whether there was a missing punch for a meal, whether there was a missing punch for a second meal on shifts that required possibly a second meal, or whether there was a punch that was late, in other words, not timely with the five-hour requirement. If you look at that apples-to-apples comparison, there was a 94.6 violation rate based on this new allegation, thereby rendering that calculation appropriate. And we provide an alternative instead of 100% violation rate, 94.8% violation rate. And that, too, gets us over the $75,000 threshold easily just through the first two causes of action. And so this is really not, to steal kind of the plaintiff's rhetoric, a case of a second bite at the apple. It's a new apple. There is a new complaint that expands the scope of the case with a brand new theory of liability that was not fleshed out in this manner, with new allegations involving Zeta, that allows us to have a new calculation that is amply supported by the record and does not constitute clear error. There is, in fact, no case that bars the defendant from changing its calculation when the scope of the complaint has changed. That would violate, we believe, the rule of removal in the procedural rules that govern removal in 28 U.S.C. 1446. That allows us 30 days, in fact, to remove a complaint, not the 14 days that the plaintiff is arguing for when the case was pending in federal court, to go and search our records if we so choose. We're actually permitted unlimited time. It's not even capped by 30 days, because under the I think it's called Cuxhausen case in the Ninth Circuit that we cite, Cuxhausen versus BMW Financial Services. If a defendant is required to go outside the complaint and rummage through their own records, the clock doesn't start for the 30-day removal. It's deemed to be indeterminate on its face. And so, but in any event, we did that timely. We did it within 30 days. And there is no error, nevertheless not clear error, on the calculation. This is a case where the plaintiff alleges all the penalties, all the harm that they intend to seek in the case. And all we did was walk through the math and apply the math to each of the harms. And then now on appeal, they want to run away on the merits on each claim, arguing, well, a citation wasn't issued, or they have an argument that certain penalties aren't permitted under Section 203, only under Section 204. And then we cite to the complaint where they allege violations of Section 204 of the Labor Code, and then their answer is, we didn't mean to assert a claim for Section 204. But as was said in the prior argument, the complaint is what it is. That is how you determine, under the case law, the amount in controversy, not the amount they'll prevail on. We think we're going to win this case, as most defendants do, but it is what's at controversy, and there is no clear error in that regard to warrant reversal. If there are any other questions on any of the issues, I'm happy to address. It's a lawyer's dream to try and argue a circuit split, but I think in this one it was a little too easy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Caffey, you can have a minute for rebuttal, or whatever you have left. What did he have left?
I had 1 minute.
You had 4 minutes, but you don't need to use it all.
I will not. But I will point out that, and this has been a consistent theme for us throughout this case, I mean, the original complaint plainly pleads the route restriction theory. So I don't understand how lawyers of that capability can say it doesn't. It says in plain, black and white, defendant had a uniform policy and practice of restricting all drivers during their alleged meal periods to remain within 1 mile or half mile radius of their designated routes. Thus, defendants did not allow plaintiff or any putative class member duty-free meal periods as required by the California Labor Code and the applicable Industrial Welfare Commission wage order. It was right there for them. Okay? The Zeta records were also right there for them in the original complaint. Footnote 5. We brought it up. Everyone knew about the Zeta records through Dela Cueva. It had all been discovered. Everyone knew they could go and get the information if they wanted to. And which
this is all very interesting, but so when did they start putting footnotes in complaints?
I guess when I got involved. I'm not sure.
I mean, I've never seen that. It's supposed to be, whatever happened to a short and plain statement? It's all gone?
Trumbo, or what's the Supreme Court case that said we now have to explain our theories? So
Twombly. Now we need footnotes in the complaint.
Well, on fear that you're going to get a district judge that says it's not concise enough. It's not, I know, no longer Rule 8, right? But the point being, it was there. And if you go back and read Seidman, I mean, if he doesn't have an obligation to go dig around if Altadena doesn't have to go dig around their records, then they shouldn't have removed the case the first time. It was a premature removal. But if they're going to do it, they should do it the right way. They had the records. They had the allegation. They should have done it the right way. And that's what Seidman stands for. And we're getting away from that because it just lets them keep going back and back and back.
Yeah.
And I'll submit to you finally that...
You'd prefer to stay in the state court, of course.
Oh, of course.
Why? The judge asked.
Why?
Yeah.
Well... I mean, there's many reasons, but I think the traditional thinking is the first of all, the case raises particular state law questions, right? So the state court should be better suited to answer those questions as opposed to the federal court. Secondly, we don't need an unanimous jury if we get the trial. And, we think we have a good panel in CCW that understands these wage and hour issues because they see them all the time, instead of putting it into the federal judiciary's lap to guess at whether or not a one-mile, route restriction, it violates the California Labor Code.
Well, unfortunately, Congress has said that if you have diverse parties and your claim is over $75,000, welcome to the federal court.
Yeah, except I submit to you that they can't keep coming back and trying to get it over $75,000. I get the diversity aspect of it, but the amount in controversy is not met. And the last point I'll make, and I know, thank you for your patience to the panel, but look, their numbers... may be plausible, our numbers may be plausible, but all doubts are supposed to be resolved against removal. This is a straight Section 1332
removal.
So
did Judge Real make a factual determination?
I don't think so. I mean, there's no analysis whatsoever other than to say that it's over 80. He went from 44 the first time to over 80 the second without any explanation. And unlike...
Well, it matches what they argued in their opposition, so we must accept that number.
Well, why reject it the first time but accept it the second time? Why take their number, not take their number the first time but take it the second time without explanation? There's fictions in law, but there's no fictions in numbers. You can add them up. We all can sit here and crank the numbers. If you crank the numbers and you do it the right way, it does not come to $75,000.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments this morning. I think that's our last case. We're done for the day, and start tomorrow.
Yep.
See you all tomorrow.
All right.